So, what do you think about, we talked a little bit about this, what do you think about trying out a compost reading material, like a little end of the show segment?
Yeah, let's do it.
Your game?
Yeah.
All right. So, listeners, Jared actually got me a book for Christmas in collaboration with my wife.
I was going to say, your wife got you a book.
Yes. And
I had Jared, nothing to do with it.
What book was it? You helped pick it out.
All right. It is I, Claudius, but I don't know who the author or anything like that is.
The author is Robert Graves. Robert Graves in...
When was it written?
1934.
Okay.
Graves was an Englishman, a veteran of the First World War.
Pretty sure that they are the only people that were allowed to write it in 1932.
Well, if because they survived the First World War, right?
That's what I mean. Nobody else had time for that shit, dude.
He was well known for a book about his experience.
I guess unless he got imprisoned for fucking starting a push, but
yeah, there you go.
Even he had to be in prison to have time to write.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, Graves was
he did it well or compellingly. He just did it.
Right. No, and the thing is unlike certain imprisoned pooch members, Graves is a really good author. Like, he's an incredible writer. And his book about the First World War, one of the best titles in literary history, Goodbye to All That, phenomenal. And actually, you know, kind of unusually for his time, I think it's worth pointing out, he was like an open bisexual. Like, he often referred to himself as like a pseudo homosexual or like a near homosexual, but he also had relationships with women. But
he did that shit in England?
Yeah, in England in the 1930s, you know, so like, you know, he was kind of ahead of his time as an intellectual, I will say, right?
Sounds and like obviously, he had a fucking set of fucking balls on him, too.
And I mean, this is contemporary to like the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany, as you pointed out, right? Where they were actively prosecuting gay people. And
I mean, they fucking sterilized the dude that invented the computer. What was his name?
Yeah, yeah. The Turing guy, right?
Yeah, being gay and or bisexual, none of that shit was cool,
right,
with most people when and where he was doing that.
So again, like, Graves is a very compelling like author, very compelling person in his own right. And I think you're going to appreciate the reason that he wrote this book, Jared. Okay. He did this out of dire economic necessity because he was flat broke thanks to some, and say it with me, everyone, bad land deals, as we so often discuss on this show.
Him basically, or his parents?
He was. He had gotten into business with a Jim Bowie type and had gotten totally fucked over. He owed like £8,000 in 1930s money. And he was like, I have to crap out some shit. I have to do some fucking urgent writing to make a buck so that they don't like start seizing my assets. And this is what happened. This book.
All right. Well, I feel like he could have just, I don't know, wrote about some way easier shit and made his money.
Well, and here's the thing, right? Like, Graves was the product of, like, you know, an English imperial education. And so what he's writing about in I, Claudius, meaning...
Oh, right, because he grew up in the position to make that bad land dealing.
I mean, exactly, right? Like, he grew up in an imperial core that was reminiscent of Rome at the time of Claudius. So in many ways, you know, he actually could, you know, pick up and probably, you know, draw relationships between what he was seeing in Britain in the early 20th century and what Claudius was experiencing in Rome in the, I guess, the first century, right?
Did he just like write a historical sitcom?
He was drawing from other contemporary historical sources like Tacitus and Suetonius. So he, and this was all stuff that he would have read a lot about when he was like growing up and going to, you know, primary school and preparatory school. he was sort of just like retelling a very, very familiar story that would have been, you know, very like well known by people from his class and upbringing. And in fact, you know, if people have listened to like Mike Duncan's History of Rome, they will also be somewhat familiar with this story, right?
All right. So he wrote the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson, but in the
movie. Yeah, and you know, it's actually pretty good.
Hey man, I like that movie.
Well,
it's ridiculous, but I don't know.
Yeah, so you know, I think that like listeners should like skip ahead to this part. You know, they can skip the rest of the episode. This is like where you want to listen, I feel like, if you're going to like go to sleep, you know, like you want to hear some nice reading.
I think we should definitely advocate for people to ignore large sections of our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll put it in the notes, like skip to 122. If, if you just want to listen to us read I Claudius.
All right. Hold on. Let's take a break then.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Oh, good old Grimer. He's just been sitting here napping next to me the entire time.
Good old Grimer. That handsome boy.
Oh, he's such a good boy.
Mike was telling me about how when he was down there, you guys were like taking a walk, and then you came around the corner and Grimer was just like whipping some cat's ass.
Oh yeah, dude. like more than one. He does that like dude, he's fucking out there. He's like fucking Tony Soprano out there, man. He's, I don't know.
I was going to say he's like Jim Bowie fighting five guys at once. He's just like, I'll take all of you. Bring it. Like, come on.
Oh, I've definitely witnessed him fighting multiple cats at the same time and kicking the shit out of all of them, dude. It is ridiculous. He came back one day and like, he had this big spot by his tail, like kind of skinned off. Mm-hmm. Like he had gotten in a fucking tussle.
Yeah.
And now it's like, seems like it's completely healed. And like, he didn't even seem like it was bothering him.
Oh my God.
Like he didn't come like limping back to the house. He came up all jolly and he was fucking meowing and rubbing my leg and he went and ate and everything. And I just like happened to be petting him and it's like, what is wrong with your back? And he's just like, ah, don't worry about that.
It's fine.
Tis but a scratch.
Oh man. All right. Well, shall we get into I Claudius?
Let's do it.
And by the way, this is public domain. So
you looked it up. I knew you would.
I did look it up because I was curious. And we could even just like record a podcast where we just read I Claudius. And that would be fine because it's public domain.
You're basically saying we could put out our own audiobook?
We totally could with this. Yeah. Because it's like that's what public domain is, right? Like we can play a public domain song. We could record it and put it out and charge money for it if we wanted to.
Well, I think we just laid out the, I don't know, justification for our Patreon.
Yes, the poor brotherhood of composters, folks. If you would like to, if you've been enjoying this podcast series and want to keep supporting our weird forays into science, history, and politics, please do consider joining at the Dan Carlin level. $1 a month. $1 per lunar cycle.
$1 a month. It's all we demand. We got to change it a little bit, right?
Yeah.
And not $1 a show. It's $1 a month.
All right. I Claudius by Robert Graves. From Tacitus, a contemporary of Claudius, a story that was the subject of every variety of misrepresentation, not only by those who then lived, but likewise in succeeding times. So true is it that all transactions of preeminent importance are wrapped in doubt and obscurity. While some hold for certain facts the most precarious hearsays, others turn facts into falsehood, and both are exaggerated by posterity. All right, we'll begin with the note from the author, Graves himself, in another tie into a recent episode. The gold piece here used as the regulatory monetary standard is the Latin aureus, a coin worth 100 sesterci, or 25 silver denarii, silver pieces. It may be thought of as worth roughly £1 sterling, or $5 American in 1934. The mile is the Roman mile, some 30 paces shorter than the English mile. The marginal dates have, for convenience, been given according to the Christian reckoning. The Greek reckoning, used by Claudius, counted the years from the first Olympiad, which took place in BC 776. For convenience also, the most familiar geographical names have been used, thus France, not Transalpine Gaul, because France covers roughly the same territorial area. And it would be inconsistent to call towns like Nîmes or Boulogne and Lyon by their modern names. Their classical ones would not be popularly recognized, while placing them in Gallia Transalpina, or as the great Greeks called it, Galatia. Greek geographical terms are most confusing. Germany was the country of the Celts, for instance. Similarly, the most familiar forms of proper names have been used. Livy for Titus Livius, Cymbeline for Cunobelinus, and Mark Antony for Marcus Antonius. It has been difficult at times to find suitable renderings for military, legal, and other technical terms. To give a single instance, there is the word assegai. Aircraftman T.E. Shaw, whom I take this opportunity of thanking for his careful reading of these proofs, questioned my use of, I believe T.E. Shaw, by the way, is T.E. Lawrence of Lawrence of Arabia. So I think Lawrence of Arabia.
T.S. Lawrence?
No, T.E. You're thinking of T.S. Eliot. Ah. But aircraftman T.E. Shaw, whom I take this opportunity of thanking for his careful reading of these proofs, questions my use of assegai as an equivalent of the German Pfrimia or Pfrein. He suggests javelin, but I have not adapted the suggestion as I have gratefully adopted others, because I need javelin for pilum, the regular missile weapon of the disciplined Roman infantrymen, and assegai is more savage sounding. Assegai has had 300-year currency in the English and acquired new vigor in the 19th century because of the Zulu Wars. The long-shafted, iron-headed Pfrimia was used, according to Tacitus, both as a missile and as a stabbing weapon. So was the assegai of the Ama-Zulu warriors, with whom the Germans of Claudius's day had culturally much in common. If Tacitus's statements, first as to the handedness of the Pfrimia at close quarters, and then as to its unmanageability among trees, are to be reconciled, the Germans probably did what the Zulus did. They broke off the end of the Pfrimia's long shaft when hand-to-hand fighting started. But it seldom came to that, for the Germans always preferred strike-and-run tactics when engaged with the better-armed Roman infantrymen. Suetonius, in his 12 Caesars, refers to Claudius's histories as written, quote, ineptly, rather than, quote, inelegantly. Yet if certain passages of the present work are not only ineptly written, but somewhat inelegantly too, the sentences painfully constructed and the digressions awkwardly placed, this is not out of keeping with Claudius's literary style, as exhibited in his Latin speech about the Aedian franchise, fragments of which survive. The speech is indeed thickly strewn with inelegancies of this sort, but then it is probably a transcription of the official shorthand record of Claudius's exact words to the Senate, the speech of a tired man conscientiously extemporizing oratory from a paper of rough notes. And, you know, preach, sister. I get that. I, Claudius, is a conversational piece of writing, as Greek, indeed, is a far more conversational language than Latin. Claudius's recently discovered Greek letter to the Alexandrians, which may, however, be partly the work of an imperial secretary, reads much more easily than the Aeduan speech. For help towards classical correctness, I have to thank Miss Airless Roberts, and for criticism of the congruity of the English, Miss Laura Writing. All right, that's the author's note. Anything you want to tease at there, Jared? You're loading up Europa Universalis on your computer, aren't you?
No, but I want to.
All right, you can do so. That's fine. I give you permission.
Nah.
All right.
I'm focused. Is that all you're reading?
No, I'm going to read chapter one. Yep, was just the author's notes. Okay. But I do think like the author's notes are kind of fun there. You kind of see a little bit of Robert Graves's kind of, early 20th century viewpoint there in terms of like comparing, you know, the Germans to the Zulus. Not exactly like problematic, but probably not like a great historical analogy, right?
Not something that would fly in this day and age, probably.
Yeah, probably not. All right. Chapter one.
Get you a good old sub.
Mm-hmm. I, Tiberius, Claudius, Drusus, Nero, Germanicus, this, that, and the other, for I shall not trouble you with all of my titles, who was once, and not so long ago either, known to my friends and relatives and associates as, quote, Claudius the Idiot, or That Claudius, or Claudius the Stammerer, or Claudius, or at best as Poor Uncle Claudius. Am now about to write this strange history of my life, starting from my earliest childhood and continuing year by year until I reached the fateful point of change where, some 8 years ago, at the age of 51, I suddenly found myself caught in what may be called the golden predicament, from which I have never since become disentangled. We get the date, the timestamp here. This is AD 41. All right. So that's the time period we're looking at. This is not by any means my first book. In fact, literature, and especially the writing of history, which as a young man I studied here at Rome under the best contemporary masters, was, until the change came, my sole profession and interest for more than 35 years. My readers must not therefore be surprised at my practiced style. It is indeed Claudius himself who is writing this book, and no mere secretary of his, and not one of those official analysts either, to whom public men are in the habit of communicating their recollections, in the hope that elegant writing will eke out meagerness of subject matter, and flattery soften voices. In the present work, I swear by all the gods, I am my own mere secretary and my own official analyst. I am writing with my own hand, and what favor can I hope to win from myself by flattery? I may add that this is not the first history of my life that I have written. I once wrote another in 8 volumes as a contribution to the city archives. It was a dull affair, by which I set little store, and only written in response to public request. To be frank, I was extremely busy with other matters during its composition, which was 2 years ago. I dictated most of the first 4 volumes to a Greek secretary of mine, and told him to alter nothing as he wrote, except where necessary for the balance of sentences and to remove contradictions and repetitions. But I admit that nearly all of the second half of the work, and some chapters at least of the first, were composed by this same fellow, Polybius, whom I named myself when a slave boy after the famous historian, from material that I gave him. And he modeled his style so accurately on mine that really, when he was done, nobody could have guessed what was mine and what was his. It was a dull book, I repeat. I was in no position to criticize the Emperor Augustus, whom was my maternal granduncle, or his third and last wife, Livia Augusta, who was my grandmother, because they had both been officially deified, and I was connected in a priestly capacity with their cults. And though I could have pretty sharply criticized Augustus's 2 unworthy imperial successors, I refrained for decency's sake. It would have been unjust to exculpate Livia, and Augustus himself insofar as he deferred to that remarkable, and let me say at once, abominable woman, while telling the truth about the other two, whose memories were not similarly protected by religious awe. I let it be a dull book, recording merely such uncontroversial facts as, for example, that so-and-so married so-and-so, the daughter of such and such, who had this or that number of political honors to his credit, but not mentioning the political reasons for the marriage, nor the behind-the-scenes bargaining between the families. Or I would write that so-and-so died suddenly after eating a dish of African figs, but say nothing of the poison or to whose advantage the death proved to be, unless the facts were supported by a verdict of the criminal courts. I told no lies, but neither did I tell the truth, in the sense that I mean to tell it here. When I consulted this book today in the Apollo Library on the Palatine Hill to refresh my memory for certain particulars of date, I was interested to come across passages in the public chapters which I could have sworn I had written or dictated, the style so peculiarly my own, and yet which I had no recollection of writing or dictating. If they were by Polybius, they were a wonderfully clever piece of mimicry. He had my other histories to study, I admit. But if they were really myself, then my memory is even worse than my enemies declare it to be. Reading over what I have just put down, I see that I must be rather exciting than disarming suspicion, first as to my sole authorship of what follows, next to my integrity as a historian, and finally as to my memory for facts. But I shall let it stand. It is myself writing, as I feel, and as the history proceeds, the reader will be the more ready to believe that. I am hiding nothing, so much to my discredit. This is a confidential history, but who, it may be asked, are my confidants? My answer is, it is addressed to posterity. I do not mean my great-grandchildren, or my great-great-grandchildren. I mean an extremely remote posterity. Yet my hope is that you, my eventual readers, of 100 generations ahead or more, will feel yourselves directly spoken to, as if by a contemporary, as often Herodotus or Thucydides, long dead, seem to speak to me. And why do I specify so extremely remote a posterity as that? I shall explain. I went to Cumae in Campania a little less than 18 years ago and visited the Sibyl in her cliff cavern on Mount Gaurus. There is always a Sibyl at Cumae, for when one dies, her novice attendant succeeds. But they are not all equally famous. Some of them are never granted a prophecy by Apollo in all the long years of their service. Others prophesy, indeed, but seem more inspired by Bacchus than Apollo, the drunken nonsense that they deliver, which has brought the oracle into discredit. Before the succession of Deiphobe, whom Augustus often consulted, and Amalthea, who is still alive and most famous, there had been a run of very poor Sibyls for nearly 300 years. The cavern lies behind a pretty little Greek temple sacred to Apollo and Artemis. Cumae was an Aeolian Greek colony. There is an ancient gilt frieze above the portico ascribed to Daedalus, though this is patently absurd, for it is no older than 500 years. If as old as that, and Daedalus lived at least 1,100 years ago. It represented the story of Theseus and the Minotaur, whom he killed in the labyrinth of Crete. Before being permitted to visit the Sibyl, I had to sacrifice a bullock and a ewe there to Apollo and Artemis, respectively. It was cold December weather. The cavern was a terrifying place, hollowed out from solid rock, the approach steep, torturous, pitch dark, and full of bats. I went disguised, but the Sibyl knew me. It must have been the stammer that betrayed me. I stammered badly as a child, and though by following the advice of specialists in elocution, I gradually learned to control my speech on set public occasions, yet on private and unpremeditated ones, I am still, though less so than formerly, liable every now and then to trip nervously over my own tongue, which is what happened to me at Cumae. I came into the inner cavern, after groping painfully on all fours up the stairs, and saw the Sibyl, more like an ape than a woman, sitting on a chair in a cage that hung from the ceiling. Her robes red and her unblinking eyes shining red in the single red shaft of light that struck down from somewhere above. Her toothless mouth was grinning. There was a smell of death about me. But I managed to force out the salutation that I had prepared. She gave me no answer. It was only sometime afterwards that I learned that this was the mummified body of Dyphabe, the previous Sybil, who had died recently at the age of 110. Her eyelids were propped up with glass marbles, silvered behind to make them shine. The reigning Sybil always lived with her predecessor. Well, I must have stood for some minutes in front of Dyphabe, shivering and making propitiatory grimaces. It seemed a lifetime. At last, the living Sybil, whose name was Amalthea, quite a young woman too, revealed herself. The red shaft of light failed, so that Dyphabe disappeared. Somebody, probably the novice, had covered up the tiny red glass window, and a new shaft, white light, struck down and lit Amalthea, seated on an ivory throne in the shadows behind. She had a beautiful, mad-looking face, with a high forehead, and sat as motionless as Dyphabe, but her eyes were closed. My knees shook, and I fell into a stammer from which I could not extricate myself. "Oh, Sib, 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 Sib," I began. She opened her eyes, frowned, and mimicked me. "Oh, clout, clout, clout." That shamed me, and I managed to remember what I had come to ask. I said with a great effort, "Oh, Sybil, I have come to question you about Rome's fate and mine." Gradually, her face changed. The prophetic power came over her. She struggled and grasped, and there was a rushing noise through all the galleries. Doors banged, wings swished by my face, the light vanished, and she uttered the Greek verse in the voice of a god. "Who groans beneath the Punic curse, and strangles in the strings of purse, before she mends must sicken worse. Her living mouth shall breed blue flies, and maggots creep about her eyes. No man shall mark the day she dies." Then she tossed her arms over her head and began again. 10 years, 50 days, and 3, clow, 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 shall given be a gift that all desire but he. To a fawning fellowship he shall stammer, cluck, and trip, dribbling always with his lip. But when he's dumb and no more here, 1900 years or near, Clau Clau Claudius shall speak clear. The god laughed through her mouth then, a lovely yet terrible sound. Ho 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 ho! I made obeisance, turned hurriedly, and went stumbling away, sprawling headlong down the first flight of broken stairs, cutting my forehead and knees, and so painfully out, and the tremendous laughter pursuing me. Speaking now as a practiced diviner, a professional historian, and a priest who has had opportunities of studying the Sibylline books as regularized by Augustus, I can interpret the verses with some confidence. By the Punic curse, the Sibyl was referring plainly to the destruction of Carthage by the Romans. We have long been under a divine curse because of that. We swore friendship and protection to Carthage in the name of our principal god, Apollo, included, and then, jealous of her quick recovery from the disasters of the Second Punic War, we tricked her into fighting the Third Punic War and utterly destroyed her, massacring her inhabitants and sowing her fields with salt. The strings of purse are the chief instruments of this curse, the money madness that has choked Rome ever since she destroyed her chief trade rival and made herself mistress of all the riches of the Mediterranean. With riches come sloth, greed, cruelty, dishonesty, cowardice, effeminacy, and every other un-Roman vice. What the gift was that all desired but myself, and it came exactly 10 years and 53 days later, you shall read in due course. The lines about Claudius speaking clear puzzled me for years, but at last I think that I understand them. They are, I believe, an injunction to write the present work. When it is written, I shall treat it with a preservative fluid, seal it in a lead casket, and bury it deep in the ground somewhere for posterity to dig up and read. If my interpretation be correct, it will be found again some 1900 years hence. And then, when all others of today whose works survive will seem to shuffle and stammer, since they have written only for today, and guardedly my story will speak out clearly and boldly. Perhaps on second thoughts, I shall not take the trouble to seal it up in a casket. I shall merely leave it lying about. For my experience as a historian is that more documents survive by chance than by intention. Apollo has made the prophecy, so I shall let Apollo take care of the manuscript. As you see, I have chosen to write in Greek, because Greek, I believe, will always remain the chief literary language of the world. And if Rome rots away, as the Sibyl has indicated, will not her language rot away with her? Besides, Greek is Apollo's own language. I shall be careful with dates, which you see I am putting in the margin, and proper names. In compiling my histories of Etruria and Carthage, I have spent more angry hours than I care to recall, puzzling out what year this or that event happened, and whether a man named so-and-so was really so-and-so, or whether he was a son or grandson or great-grandson, or no relation at all. I intend to spare my successors this sort of irritation. Thus, for example, of the several characters in the present history who have the name of Drusus, my father, myself, a son of mine, my first cousin, my nephew, each will be plainly distinguished wherever mentioned. And for example, again, in speaking of my tutor, Marcus Porcius Cato, I must make it clear that he was neither Marcus Porcius Cato the censor, instigator of the Third Punic War, nor his son of the same name, the well-known jurist, nor his grandson, the consul of the same name, nor his great-grandson of the same name, Julius Caesar's enemy, nor his great-great-grandson of the same name who fell at the Battle of Philippi, but an absolutely undistinguished great-great-grandson. Still of the same name, who never bore any public dignity, and who deserved none. Augustus,
<that guy. laughs>
Augustus made him my tutor, and afterwards schoolmaster to other young Roman noblemen and sons of foreign kings. For though this name entitled him to position of the highest dignity, his severe, stupid, pedantic nature qualified him for nothing better than to the that of the elementary schoolmaster.
Burn on teachers, damn.
Dude, that's you talking about your El Duce. All right. To fix the date to which these events belong, I can do no better, I think, than to say that my birth occurred in the 744th year after the foundation of Rome by Romulus, and in the 767th year of the first Olympiad, and that the Emperor Augustus, whose name is unlikely to perish, even in 1900 years of history, had by then been ruling for 20 years. This would be in BC 10 in our timeline. Before I close this introductory chapter, I have something more to add about the Sibyl and her prophecies. I've already said that at Cumae, when one Sibyl dies, another succeeds, but that some are more famous than others. There was one very famous one, Demophili, whom Aeneas consulted before his descent into hell. And there was a latter one, Herophili, who came to King Tarquin and offered him a collection of prophecies at a higher price than he wished to pay. Of course, I'm going to jump in. King Tarquin, last like king of the Roman kingdom before it became the Republic. When he refused, so the story runs, she burnt apart and offered what was left at the same price, which he again refused. Then she burned another part and offered what was left, still at the same price, which, for curiosity, this time he paid. Herophili's oracles were of two kinds, warning or hopeful prophecies of the future, and directions for the suitable propitiatory sacrifices to be made when such and such portents occurred. To these were added, in the course of time, whatever remarkable and well-attested oracles were uttered to private persons. Whenever, then, Rome has seemed threatened by strange portents or disasters, the Senate orders a consultation. A consultation of the books by the priests whom have charge of them, and a remedy is always found. Twice the books were partially destroyed by fire, and the lost prophecies restored by the combined memories of the priests in charge. These memories seem in many instances to have been extremely faulty. This is why Augustus set to work on an authoritative canon of the prophecies, rejecting obviously uninspired interpolations or restorations. He also called in and destroyed all unauthorized private collections of Sibylline oracles, as well as all other books of public prediction that he could lay his hands upon, to the number of over 2,000. The revised Sibylline books he put in a locked cupboard under the pedestal of Apollo's statue in the temple which he built for the god close to his own palace on the Palatine Hill. A unique book from Augustus's private historical library came into my possession sometime after his death. It was called Sibylline Curiosities, being such prophecies found incorporated in the original canon as have been rejected as spurious by the priests of Apollo. So these are like heretical verses. The verses were copied out in Augustus's own beautiful script, with the characteristic misspellings which originally made from ignorance he ever afterwards adhered to as a point of pride. Most of these verses were obviously never spoken by the Sibyl either in ecstasy or out of it, but composed by irresponsible persons who wished to glorify themselves or their houses, or to curse the houses of rivals by claiming divine authorship for their own fanciful predictions against them. The Claudian family had been particularly active, I noticed, in these forgeries. Yet, I found one or two pieces whose language proved them respectably archaic and whose inspiration seemed divine, and whose plain and alarming sense had evidently decided Augustus, his word was law among the priests of Apollo, against admitting them into his canon. This little book I no longer have, but I can recall almost every word of one of the most memorable of these seemingly genuine prophecies, which was recorded both in the original Greek and, like most early pieces in the canon, in a rough Latin verse translation. It ran thus: 100 years of the Punic curse, and Rome will be slave to a hairy man. A hairy man that is scant of hair. Every man's woman, and each woman's man. The steed that he rides shall have toes for hooves. He shall die at the hand of his son, no son, and not in the field of war. The hairy one next to enslave the state shall be son, no son, of his hairy last. He shall have hair and a generous mop. He shall give Rome marble in place of clay, and fetter her fast with unseen chains, and shall die at the hand of his wife, no wife, to the gain of his son, no son. The hairy third to enslave the state shall be son, no son, of his hairy last. He shall be mud well mixed with blood, a hairy man that is scant of hair. He shall give Rome victories and defeat, and die to the gain of his son, no son. A pillow shall be his sword. The hairy fourth to enslave the state shall be son, no son, of his hairy last. A hairy man that is scant of hair. He shall give Rome poisons and blasphemies, and die from a kick of his aged horse that carried him as a child. The hairy fifth to enslave the state, though against his will, shall be that idiot whom all despised. He shall have hair and a generous mop. He shall give Rome water and winter bread, and die at the hand of his wife, no wife, to the gain of his son, no son. The hairy sixth to enslave the state shall be son, no son, of this hairy last. He shall give Rome fiddlers and fear and fire. His hand shall be red with a parent's blood. No hairy seventh to him succeeds, and blood shall gush from his tomb. Now, it must have been plain to Augustus that the first of the hairy ones, that is, the Caesars, for Caesar means a head of hair, was his granduncle Julius who adopted him. Julius was bald, and he was renowned for his debaucheries with either sex. And his war charger, as is a matter of public record, was a monster which had toes instead of hooves. Julius escaped alive from many hard-fought battles, only to be murdered at last in the Senate House by Brutus. And Brutus, though fathered on another, was believed to be Julius's natural son. "Thou too, child," said Julius, as Brutus came at him with a dagger. Of the Punic curse I have already written, Augustus must have recognized in himself the second of the Caesars. Indeed, he himself at the end of his life made a boast, looking at the temples and public buildings that he had splendidly re-edified, and thinking too of his life's work in strengthening and glorifying the empire, that he had found Rome in clay and left her in marble. But as for the manner of his death, he must have found the prophecy either unintelligible or incredible, yet some scruple kept him from destroying it. Who the hairy third and the hairy fourth and the hairy fifth were in this story will be plainly shown. And I am indeed an idiot if, granting the oracle's unswerving accuracy in every particular up to present, I do not recognize the hairy sixth, rejoicing on Rome's behalf that there will be no hairy seventh to succeed him. And that's the end of the first chapter. So Claudius has given us a little bit of broader context of Rome's history, right? From
a little bit of his own writing history as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's like, if you hated my last book, well, so did I.
Yeah.
Give me another chance.
Yeah. You know, he's kind of like getting at also the Roman values, right? Like being big on masculinity, family, honor, right?
Virtues. Claudius was just a bit too flamboyant for Rome, sounds like.
Yeah.
And they thought he was stupid because of it.
And also they had this value on rhetoric, on like the ability to like speak and persuade, right? And Claudius had
you got to be able to bullshit.
Yeah, Claudius.
Even if you're a piece of shit, you got to be able to convince people that maybe you're not.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, Claudius is kind of this interesting outsider in that world, right? But he's gonna try and tell like essentially the real story of the fall of the House of Caesar, right? Kind of tracking it from Augustus through himself.
Yeah, this is the VH1 Behind the Music.
Yeah, it's Behind the Roman Empire, the early years.
Real Housewives of the Roman Republic.
Yeah, Real Housewives of the Palatine Hill. But I don't know. It is kind of wild, though, thinking about visiting an oracle, right? Like, they just don't do religion like they used to, man.
I don't know. They just sound like... I don't even know.
I want to see, like, a mummified, like, dead witch. And then think it's the live witch. And then have the live witch surprise me.
Yeah, it's like some fucking Geralt of Rivia shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Do you think there's any like connections we can tie in with our, you know, cosmology we were talking about earlier in the episode, Jared?
I think as we get further and further away from a time with oracles, we actually become closer to a time with oracles.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think it also is kind of like what Tacitus talks about in that introductory paragraph. Sort of the nature of time as it expands, like what you're talking about, creates this almost quantum state of like interpretation and meaning, right? That, you know, while some hold on for certain facts in the most precarious hearsays, others turn facts into falsehoods. It's just sort of like this thing that is almost entropic in nature as history goes along.
Yeah, wouldn't it be really weird to live in a time like that?
But yeah, so that's our first installation in I, Claudius.
I like it.
Cool. All right, well, as we often do, Jared, anything you want to wrap up with?
Take some time for yourself and maybe reflect on your great-great-great-grandfather who has the same name as you.
There you go. Yeah. Some things never change. Fermente sto salibia, fermente sto salibia, vola d'aquila legionu, vola d'aquila legionu, sopra terra britanoru, sopra terra britanoru, vola d'aquila legionu, vola d'aquila legionu, legio eterno, eterno, legio eterno, eterno, legio eterno, eterno. Italica suavi, Italica suavi, nostro munus patri marti, nostro munus patri marti, Italica suavi, Italica suavi, nostro munus patri marti, nostro munus patri marti, legio eterno, eterno, vitis, legio eterno, eterno, vitis, legio eterno, eterno, vitis, legio. Eterno, eterno, legio, eterna, eterna, vivis.